questions?
I was concerned about your emphasis on electric cars and your hope that we could run grids and transport with non-carbon dioxide producing energy. Yep. I come from your side of the fence, totally concerned, much more worried than you are, as a matter of fact. There were three points that I'd like to make there. First of all, you did mention you want to have 2 million at cars, little cars that cost the 40,000 each, and that is $80 billion. So that's one hell of a cost, and it will take a long time. But the two more important issues, I think, first of all, what gets me concerned about electric vehicles is that we generate about 34% of our electricity now from coal and gas. So that therefore using electricity and keeping the same number of vehicles going is hardly going to do anything. And finally, there's the question of the full transport mix, because you were talking about small cars, and a lot of transport is trucks and so on. And at the moment, something like half of New Zealand energy is oil, and something like 27% is electricity. And you can see one doesn't go with the other. So I think myself that the problem is far more severe than you're suggesting, and the electric cars will do very little.
Okay. Just taking all three points. The first one, $80 billion, you're not going to do that overnight. The other point I made about electric cars is just how simple they are. These things will be a fraction of the cost of regular cars in an equitable market eventually. So $80 billion in today's dollars, but I think that's going to reduce dramatically once these things are mass-produced. The second point had to do with you're burning coal to make electricity, which you then run in a car, right? How is this going to result in CO2 savings? It does substantially, because what's going on in California now is exactly that, except there it's all virtually 100% coal and oil, fossil generation of electricity, because of the innate or inherent efficiency of an electric motor. And so you're far better off if you have to burn something, burning coal to make electricity in a good power plant, and then running electric vehicles on that, than having all of those individual electric vehicles running around burning coal, burning oil, burning petrol and diesel rather. Okay, the third point about the mix, I think you said 30%, 34% is it?
It's that sort of percentage.
Anyone else here want to? Because I thought actually we were around 80% renewable.
No, it's gone down.
It's gone down, is it?
It depends on the year.
Okay, well, to me, this is part of the issue, is to get that renewable energy mixed up. And it's there, you know, the technology is there to do it. It's going to cost, but we're already paying lots for electricity. So these things are doable.
I'm worried about doing the full arithmetic, because you can save a bit here and a bit there, it's all worthwhile, but does it really add up to a very substantial amount on the national scene? And the problem that you're presenting to us that we all know about, the climate change and so on, means that we should be cutting back enormously. And one can't see us cutting back enormously unless we were to make a change in our economy that I don't see on the horizon at all.
That is the issue, isn't it? We have to change, and we're not going to spend $80 billion on cars immediately. Sorry.
In your talks with Gareth Morgan, did you ever talk about the shape an economy would be if we did the things that you need to do to cut back? Because it seems to me that it suits the government, because they probably realise what would happen.
That's the next book, Jenna.
There's no sign that the general public actually realises what would happen if you did these things.
Yeah.
Does he talk to you about
it? Oh, yes.
And what does he think?
Well, the first thing is that he he says that we have to change. You know, he's seen the scope of this problem, and we just cannot continue on the way we're going.
But can he sort of model it in his head?
No, no economist can do that.
Because just take a simple thing, for instance, if we decided that the agricultural industry wasn't going to use fossil fuel-based fertilizers, and that stopped, so what would happen immediately? Productivity would go down, we'd have less foreign exchange, we wouldn't be able to buy all these electric cars. You know, if you just kind of work through everything like that.
Yeah, University of Waikato want to build the cars for us.
And how much energy does it make to make a, take to make a lithium battery?
Not very much, actually. A lot less than a regular lead-acid battery. And in terms of recycling, they're a lot more benign.
I feel we have to work these things through more,
mm-hmm.
out loud.
Yeah, the life cycle analysis is very important in all of this stuff.
Yeah. So that we all get the... I mean, my personal feeling is that we have to actually have a lower energy input society, and we have to be lower our standards of living and do things in a more labour-intensive way.
The off-grid house that I built for Lloyd Jones, the author of Mr. Pup, he uses 2 to 3 kilowatt hours a day. He doesn't think his standard of living has dropped. An average off-grid house in New Zealand uses 25 kilowatt hours a day. So what is going on?
So what's the difference?
An order of magnitude, Jenna.
No, I'm meaning, does he not have water heating and a big reservoir?
He has solar hot water heating and a house which has been designed to collect the sun. And so solar gain. He goes out and chops wood. We're locked into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I don't see his standard of living as any less than yours or mine.
No, I mentioned another thing that locks us in is that the power companies charge a high daily price for the electricity. So there's no incentive to use less. We actually use very little electricity, but we don't notice the difference in our bills.
Yeah.
We're just paying a daily rate that seems to go up and up and up as they take away the perks that they used to have for low use or off-peak use and those sorts of things. So that might be a way of tackling it. If the power companies could be persuaded one way or the other, not allowed to charge a daily rate, only a rate for what people use.
Yeah. No, they're called lines charges and they're prohibitive. Especially if you live out in the country, they can often be well over $100 a month. It's the government that owns most of those power companies, by the way.
There's actually an Otago University project going on at the moment looking at the marginal cost of power in the retirement house in Auckland, seeing what will happen to his behaviour if they increase or decrease the marginal cost of power.
Thank you, I really enjoyed your talk. I suppose there are some such big questions here that it's quite difficult to get your head around the entirety, but I think two observations. The first is that people, us and everybody else, are notoriously difficult to help them change their mind, change their direction, change their habits. Especially when money is involved,
is
actually very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And I think this impinges directly on the climate change issue. But the other thing is that the key here, I believe, is not to do that, but to do it behind the back door. I'm the research manager for the Climate Commission for the Environment. We just released a report on smart meters. Now these things, if implemented correctly, are one of the ways that people could use a lot less energy and not notice.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. In an ideal world, it would be good if people had a Damascus Road experience and changed their lifestyle. But my experience tells me that that's exceptional. That the normal way is to facilitate things that people need to make a decision once, and then it happens automatically. So, entirely with you.
Yeah. that buy-in that I talked about, getting the public to realise, if I get on this, there are actually incentives for me.
Mm.
And I mentioned smart metering. It really is working extremely well overseas. And as I said, if you live off-grid, you use less power. The power system that I have at home, which is off-grid because of the bureaucracy, I can't connect it. You manage the power. You look at it very, very carefully.
Okay, would you like to make any comments about non-CO2 greenhouse gases? You've likely focused on CO2, and most of the protocols and so on that we adhere to internationally are framed in terms of CO2 equivalents rather than CO2, which implies some fixed relationship between the different gases relative to CO2. Now, unfortunately, non-CO2 green gases are inextricably tied up with things like food production. Would you like to comment on do you think there should be some more flexibility in that?
I can tell you my personal opinion on that, and it really comes from the IPCC experience. And just the shattering realisation that CO2 is with us essentially forever. You put it in the atmosphere, there are various estimates of the lifetime, as you know. But it's so far and beyond a human lifetime that anything that we release is going to be there forever. Methane, the main agricultural gas, lifetime against attack by hydroxyl radicals, 9 years, 10 years, it's gone. I think in terms of putting effort in, if we have limited resources, we have to tackle CO2. And maybe leave the farmers alone.
Very interesting. You talk about the possibility of a moratorium on coal, wide plants, and about the electrical vehicles, which is all very interesting. And imagine that New Zealand in 10 years' time, or like that, there were no coal-fired plants, and all the vehicles were electrical. But New Zealand was allowing fossil fuels to be taken from its waters and shipped overseas to major companies like Shell or Exxon or whatever. How would that contribution affect the balance that has been generated to the atmosphere from CO2 indirectly, because it's an indirect effect, but you're still doing it, and we're talking a multi-million-dollar effect.
Well, I don't like it at all. I hate the fact that we export coal. And as I said, I found it a strange dichotomy that the Labor government ratified the Kyoto Protocol and yet owned a company that exports coal, mostly to China. The way the Kyoto Protocol and emissions agreements work is that it's where the emissions are done that counts. So that coal, even though it came from New Zealand, if it's burned in China or Vietnam or wherever, it's their emissions.
So,
it's a strange world.
Yeah, that's an example. The other one is the portion of the passage of water that are up at the moment, for example, around Northland, New Zealand, etc. But I guess those are just points that people have to bear in mind as indirect effects.
Yeah. I agree.
Last question, very time for us. Just briefly, I was wondering if you could comment on the role of the population growth and this by getting that set up. All the things we talked about, will they obviously make a big impact on reducing carbon footprint to the atmosphere? My only question is that the underlying forcing function, especially exponential, is built to the population and the change in standards of living for a large percentage of the population. So I'm just wondering, at what point do we start talking about what's to develop?
World population growth, I don't know if you've followed it recently, but the growth rate has actually slowed quite dramatically.
But it's still increasing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it will do. It's estimated that we'll reach 9 billion before it actually starts to go down. To me, if you look at education, you look at countries who know about issues like climate change, well educated, motivated, their emissions go down. I don't see why the sensibly managed couldn't support 9 billion people. But you can't support them all eating beef or driving Hummers powered by diesel. A very different kind of way of life for humans, but not necessarily a bad one.
Yes, my own take on the inclusion would be that it's the civilization, the countries with a higher standard of living are where the population is reduced, and it's mostly immigration from third world countries that are adding to the population of these countries that use it. So isn't there a possibility of improving the standard of living of people while at the same time improving the resources, that might be an important approach for it seems like it's not being talked about much.
Yeah, no.
It's about 20 years ago, people were very concerned about
it. Yeah, no, it's a very good point. Stuff. Yeah, and thanks for that.
Thanks very much, David. We will give you a break now. 4 minutes from close, but I'd just like to join with me and thank you, Dave, again for a really special.